elections.pacifica.org if you cannot find your ballot. Members without access to the internet can leave a voicemail for the election supervisor at 510-854-9663. It's 99.5 FM WBAI in New York and online at WBAI.org.
Ladies and gentlemen, good night. That last program was Counterspin, hosted by Janine Jackson. That can be heard every Monday from 6:30 to 7 p.m. Get ready for the next show. It's going to be Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash coming up.
And this is Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. I would like to note that the views expressed in this program by Building Bridges and our guests, Sean Richmond and Sarah Nelson, are not the views of WBAI Radio or the Pacifica Network. Later on, a union president talks general strike and reignites the spark of labor militancy with Sarah Nelson, president of the Association of Flight Attendants. But first, how can we put a labor union in every workplace with Sean Richmond, who spent a decade and a half as a union organizer and representative? He was a deputy director for organizing for the American Federation of Teachers, where he ran the union's National Charter School Organizing Division. As a writer, he has focused on union strategy and structure and proposals for labor law reform. He's been published in the American Prospect, In These Times, Jacobin, the New York Daily News, the New York Times, the Staten Island Advance, the Washington Post, and Vox. He currently serves as the program director of the Harry Van Osdell Jr. Center for Labor Studies at SUNY Empire State College. Well, it's about time that workers demanded more, much more. Sean Richmond brings his expertise to the table to analyze the most recently released plan of Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, titled the Workplace Democracy Plan, WDP, for furthering workers' interests collectively, both in the private and the public sector. He'll talk about whether, in his opinion, the WDP can facilitate workers' bargaining power through, among other things, facilitating a union in every workplace and returning to workers the right to strike as a check on the power of capital. Since the New Deal legislation, there's been a weakening of worker protections both in the courts and with the new waves of right-wing anti-labor legislation, rules and regulations, and agency appointments. Richmond brings his extensive knowledge to the table to assess whether the WDP proposals offer a sword and or a shield to defend against the war waged on private and public sector employees. And Sean Richmond, welcome to WBAI's Building Bridges.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Sean, this new proposal by Bernie Sanders is complicated, and it's voluminous in certain ways in the number of different proposals that Bernie has put out there. So why don't you give us an introduction first as to what's in the plan, given the fact that for the last 40 to 50 years, the labor movement has been the defensive against labor laws which seek to destroy it.
So let's set some context first. The sort of amazing thing about where we are right now is that the Senate and Congressional Democrats' official labor law proposal right now, their bill, which of course doesn't stand a chance of passing in the current Congress, essentially calls for the repeal of Taft-Hartley. And that's the Protecting the Right to Organize Act, or the PRO Act. So in that context, where the Senate Dems and the House Dems are saying, let's repeal Taft-Hartley, what you're seeing among the candidates for the presidential nomination is a race to the left, where repealing Taft-Hartley is now the floor, but we have to do better than that. And so specifically on amending the National Labor Relations Act, Bernie, of course, supports the PRO Act. He also goes further to more explicitly legislatively repeal this 1937 Supreme Court decision, McKay, that allows employers to permanently replace economic strikers. He reinserts some items that were in the failed Employee Free Choice Act that didn't make its way over to the PRO Act, and that's specifically card check certification for all new unions and binding arbitration for a first contract if the parties cannot come to a reasonable agreement. And all of that is great, but given, you know, look, we've seen, you know, employers go out of their way to evade the employer-based labor relations framework in this country. We've seen them, you know, they'll call you a subcontractor, they'll call you an independent contractor, they'll ship your jobs overseas, they'll shut down their workplace, given that, you know, we've seen the Gothamist, you know, shut its doors after the workers voted for a union. So to really bring unions back, in a real way, we need some proposals that transcend the sort of the workplace-based exclusive representation, you know, model where the union lives or dies in a specific workplace. And so Bernie's got a lot of stuff here that is really exciting. First and foremost, and closest to my heart, he proposes a just cause standard of employment under the law. And just cause is, you know, it's the basic reasonable principle that you can't be fired for a bad reason or no reason. You have to be fired because it's justified, and that you get to have your day in court and defend your job. This, of course, is very commonly negotiated into union contracts. It is also in the education profession. It's what we know of as tenure. Corporate executives have this because they all have individual contracts. But for the vast majority of workers, we don't have these kinds of protections. And this is really, it's a foundational problem in the law, and really from the word go is a part of the fundamental imbalance of employers' powers versus workers' powers. You know, the ability, having just cause gives a worker, non-union or with a union, the ability to say no, you know, to turn down a job assignment that is really outside the bounds of you know, what you signed up for, like going up to Matt Lauer's hotel room or some of these other stories we've heard out of Me Too. Not my job, dude. You get to say that. Right now, there are certainly protections for, against a racially biased or gender biased discrimination, but the burden is on the employee to prove that it was a bad firing. What just cause does is it flips the script and it puts the burden on the employer to justify that the termination was in fact justified. So it would be a huge sea change in workers' rights, and in my experience, it actually does help unions organize. First of all, there are legal protections under the National Labor Relations Act for employers for employees who organize a union, but it falls to the same standard where it's up to the workers and the union to prove that it was a bad firing, rather than the standard of you have a right to your job, and because it's a special right, it's harder to defend. So that's a huge deal. And actually, Bernie is the third Democratic candidate to come out in favor of just cause, which is pretty wild, because this was an issue that wasn't really on the agenda not that long ago. But Bill de Blasio called for it in his platform, and John Hickenlooper, before he dropped out, also endorsed it. And we may see more candidates endorse this. We're still sort of waiting for Elizabeth Warren's labor platform. The other thing that Bernie proposes, and this one really would put a union in every workplace, is he proposes what his platform calls sectoral bargaining, which is, you know, it exists on a voluntary basis in some industries in America. It exists in much more commonly in other countries, both voluntarily and as a part of the legal framework. And the idea here is that rather than negotiate terms at a specific employer only, so rather than just negotiating terms at, say, Verizon telephone, it is a venue to negotiate the wages and benefits for workers across an entire industry, so across, say, the entire telecom industry. And once a rule is made there, and it applies equally to, you know, to T-Mobile, to Verizon, to AT&T, you've essentially taken that issue out of competition, that the employers are no longer competing over how little they can pay people, how stingy they can make any particular benefit, and it makes the wins a lot more durable. Now, he's calling it sectoral bargaining. He's very clear in his platform that he's not presenting a ready-made package, and that whatever he's going to do has to involve the input of unions. You know, look, there's a lot of fear of the unknown. I think that even the phrase bargaining is somewhat, it will prove to be somewhat inaccurate. Because this is not bargaining as we understand it, in the United States. Not collective bargaining as we understand it. The model and sort of, you know, the influence of various academics and researchers that you can see their influence on the proposal are really looking at models of sort of tripartite rulemaking. So that's a system where there's a representative of the workers, where there might be multiple unions representing the workers, a representative of the employers, where of course there are multiple employers in an industry, and a third party that is supposed to be neutral, so a representative of the public. And, you know, it's a board that can make a new rule that applies across the board. Most notably and most recently in America, New York State dusted off a Depression era, New Deal era wage board that still existed, to effectively legislate the $15 an hour minimum wage in the fast food industry. And, you know, it was a real sort of back to the future kind of thing. This is, you know, this is a wage board that people probably forgot existed around 1959. But the process of utilizing this, and it was, the fix was not in. There was no guarantee that SEIU was going to win a $15 minimum wage using this wage board. A lot of people saw this as potentially a sellout move, and nobody really trusted the governor. But the process of it, has really it's made folks at SEIU true believers in this model, and they are very eager to export and expand it around the country. And I think that is a major reason why you see it in Bernie's platform.
Sean, let's drill a little bit deeper into let's start with organizing, okay? Organizing a union.
Yep.
There's a lot of things that you mentioned that relate to that, including just cause. There's a lot of things that you couldn't get in because of the time element. So let's talk about some of those. Let's talk about the first contract provisions. Let's talk about the public sector. Let's talk about bargaining organizing unions in the public sector. Let's talk about groups that have been excluded from the collective bargaining process,
yep.
The farm workers and domestic workers since the 30s, which is really a racist act of excluding domestic workers and farm workers from the protections of not only collective bargaining, but also the minimum wage. So why don't we talk a little bit card check authorization for recognition. Let's talk about how this affects getting a union in the first place.
Okay, well, let's start with the holes in the National Labor Relations Act. As you alluded to, the act, you know, it doesn't cover all workers, and a lot of workers were intentionally not covered from the very beginning, mainly in order to get votes. You know, it was not an easy law to pass in 1935, and the New Deal coalition You know, it had what is now the constituency of the Republican Party, but white, racist Southern Democrats were crucial. Their votes were crucial to get the act passed. And so in order to get their votes, it excluded their workers. So farm workers and domestic workers are not covered by the act. It's a terrible omission, and it excludes, you know, and always has excluded millions of black workers. Government employees were also not covered by the act. And that, you know, that was just to get congressional votes. Congressmen were like, I don't want my staff forming a union against me, so we're against this.
And in the states also.
Yes. So what Bernie's proposing is a fairly straightforward amendment to the National Labor Relations Act to put domestic and farm workers under that act. And for public sector workers, he's endorsing two other bills that are out there. And forgive me, I can't recall what the name of the bill or who's proposing them. But this is not Bernie's idea. These are ideas that are out there. One bill would simply codify proper legal collective bargaining for federal sector workers. Right now, there's a series of executive orders and laws that you know, let them have a kind of union, sort of a meet and confer relationship, but there's no formal bargaining, and also it's right to work. There is no union shop there. And you know, a historical note here, of course, is that in 1981, when the air traffic controllers went on strike, which resulted in Ronald Reagan firing them all and sort of changing the course of his presidency and changing the course of history, the reason they were on strike is that the federal government was simply refusing to bargain over wages, and they had spent 10 years as a union in bargaining, but not bargaining over the things that they wanted to, and they had convinced themselves that the only way to fix that was to show their might as workers and withdraw their labor, and to some extent it was just sort of a tragic accident of timing that it resulted that way. By having the right to strike, I think you're actually less likely to see strikes in the federal zone. So it's a very interesting proposal. And then there's another law that would simply create. It looks to me like it would create sort of a new labor board. So it wouldn't simply take state and municipal workers and put them under the NLRB. It does sort of acknowledge that the issues are different, and therefore, you know, there should be a separate labor board. But it would give them substantially the same sorts of rights as workers who are protected by the NLRB. So the right to have a collective bargaining election, the right to engage in contracts, and that this can't be abrogated by, you know, any Scott Walker that comes walking by.
Yeah, and
it doesn't leave the issue up to the states
certain
any
states,
longer.
Public, the state public and city public employees do have the right to strike over some issues.
In certain, it's a patchwork is what we have currently.
Yeah. Yeah.
And obviously in New York, we have one of the worst laws around public employees striking. But you've also got, you know, in Texas, the Constitution forbids any agency of the government from recognizing a union and entering into collective bargaining. So that all gets wiped away if a bill like this gets passed. And that is a big deal for millions of workers in this country. What else are we covering here? The binding arbitration for a first agreement.
Yeah, getting a union in the first place. Yeah.
So getting a union in the first place. I mean, I think I imagine most of your listeners have some sense of how rigged the NLRB election system is in favor of workers, in favor of employers, rather. The moment that a representation petition is filed, it sets the clock, and the employer can run a campaign where they can bring you into captive audience meetings all day long. If you don't attend, you're fired. They can lie to you. They can threaten your job as long as they sort of couch it as an economic prediction. They of course do fire workers all the time, even though that's illegal. By the time it's fixed, the election has already happened. So there's this whole gauntlet that workers have to face in an NLRB certification election to even win the right to get to the bargaining table. And so Cardcheck sidesteps that and says, look, if you can get the majority of the employees to vote on a petition that they want a union, that's good enough. There's no reason to make them vote a second time. That is certification. And you know, Cardcheck is, you know, it is, it's a 100% turnout election. because on the day you start signing those cards, you start signing those petitions, you're starting with every worker as a no vote, and your job as an organizer is to get enough people to actively sign the petition to become yes votes. Under an NLRB election, you simply have to win a majority of those workers who turn out to vote. So it's more democratic, in addition to everything else. But winning your certification and getting to the bargaining table still doesn't get you a union. In about half the cases where a new union is certified, the workers never get a contract. And that's because there's no requirement to agree to a contract. All the employer has to do is bargain in quote-unquote good faith, and there's a lot of case law around what that involves, and that basically means you keep pushing paper back and forth. They have to respond to you know, what you're saying. You know, they have to give counterproposals, but they don't have to agree to you. They don't have to agree to salary increases at all. You know, they can just say, look, we have other priorities, so we're not going to give you a raise.
And Sean, we have about 5 minutes left to talk about what I would like to talk about, the Taft-Hartley Act, insofar as it covers secondary boycotts, and far as the right to work laws, and also in terms of the other impediments to collective bargaining within the law.
So the way that right to work works legally is...
I love that term, right to work.
It's a section of the federal law that says, hey, on this question, we're not going to have federal law supremacy. Because in all other matters of labor rights, federal law, if federal law says something, the states can't say something different. The federal law is supreme. But on the question of the union shop, of the idea that where a union has the obligations of exclusive representation of a group of workers at a workplace, the workers who are protected by that contract should have to pay a reasonable fee for the services of that union, the Taft-Hartley Act says, well, unless a state says they don't want that. And, you know, when that law passed in 1947, the South seceded. Every southern state very quickly passed a right-to-work law that made the union shop illegal in that state. And it kind of stayed there. But over time, the Sun Belt states started passing it, and then we saw during the Tea Party era that the Republicans realized way better than the Democrats do that unions are crucial to Democrats' get-out-the-vote operations. And so we saw all of these states in the Midwest, all of these rock-solid, Democratic states passing right-to-work laws. And you know, there's some research out there that itself might account for Trump's victory. If Trump, who lost the popular vote around the country by 3 million votes, he wins three crucial states in the Electoral College, and those states are in the case of Michigan and Wisconsin, those are states that had recently gone right to work, and very narrowly went for him, and probably because of the loss of union membership. So that is something that's in the PRO Act. That is something that is now the Congressional Democrats' position is right to work is wrong for America. And of course, all of this huge caveat, they say this now when they can't pass it, let's see what happens in 2021. But that's kind of a big deal.
And Sean, we only have a few minutes left, but I do want to get in the secondary boycott provisions under Taft-Hartley.
The secondary boycott provision.
And the permanent replacement of workers in strikes.
Yeah. So secondary boycott is actually the worst thing that Taft-Hartley did to workers.
Because
it outlaws solidarity. It restricts job actions to you and your immediate employer. And it sort of forbids workers from sort of extending a fight to another company who either depends on your employer or who your employer depends upon. So it really takes away your ability to put this sort of leverage on the bosses. It takes away your ability to do solidarity, right? Like if you look at a situation, when the Oreo factory was sent overseas and those workers in Chicago were going to lose their job, it's one thing, when you're protesting a factory that's about to get shut down. The real power, obviously, would be if supermarket workers all over the country said, "We're not putting Oreo cookies on the shelves.
Right.
We're throwing them out the back." That's what Taft-Hartley. That's what secondary boycott makes illegal, and that obviously, really restricts worker power.
Okay. And last but not least, you're on strike. replacement workers, scab, come in, and then when the contract is signed, they get your job.
And this is a thing that actually happened in 1937. I don't think people realize this. There was a bad Supreme Court decision in 1937 that said, you know, even though the National Labor Relations Act clearly says no one can be, you know, you have the right to strike, nothing in this act is going to limit the right to strike. Bad decision says, well, of course, you know, an employer is allowed to protect and continue his business, and so if he needs to find permanent replacements, he should. And it just sort of sat out there for decades until after Reagan fires the air traffic controllers, and employers say, oh, game on, we're going to start busting our unions. You have a copper mining company in Arizona called Phelps Dodge,
right,
that you know, basically bargained their workers to impasse over draconian concessions, and recruited a whole bunch of scabs from out of state, and replaced the strikers and waited 12 months so that those strikers now had the right to vote the union out, and the workers never got their jobs back. And that became the playbook for corporate America, and that is why you see a drastic decline in strikes afterwards. It's not PATCO, it's Phelps Dodge. And so the right to strike, what Bernie is saying, is the right to strike means nothing unless you have the right to return to the job after the strike is over. And so Bernie's bill would legislatively overturn this terrible Supreme Court decision from 1937 called McKay.
Well, Sean, we're just about out of time. We've got one more minute, so can you sum it up in 1 minute?
I think what's exciting about this moment, I think, is that we're seeing this race to the left on labor ideas. And I think that for union people, our challenge should be whoever gets the nomination, every idea that got put out there that was good, yes, and that we carry these through, and they continue to be our demands. Repealing Taft-Hartley is essential. It is not enough to put a union in every workplace in America. So we need wage boards, we need sectoral bargaining, we need just cause, we need dues checkoff by law. I can't wait to see what Warren's going to come out with in her platform, and I'm morbidly curious what Biden's going to come out with.
Yeah, we'll see what Biden comes out.
You know, okay. The challenge is there.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Sean Richmond, for making this information digestible and presenting so much in so short a period of time. And we have to get you on back later, some other day, to parse some of this stuff out more and flesh it out and see where the proposals are going. So thank you very much.
I'd love to do it. All right.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. What's going on? There's a war zone here today out in the heartland. But the union to stay. Those multinational bastards don't use tanks and guns, it's true, but they declared a war on us right now, and by God it's up to you, cause there's a war on the workers. There's a war on the workers. There's a war on the workers, and it's time we started calling the shots.
And now a union president talks general strike and reignites the spark of labor militancy with Sarah Nelson, president of the Association of Flight Attendants. When we mention Sarah Nelson, the president of the Association of Flight Attendants, to people in the labor movement, the response is usually something like, I would follow her to the gates of hell. For a few years, we heard union members and staffers rave about Nelson's fearlessness and willingness to show up support of others. But she became a progressive superstar for the broader workers' movement only in the early 2019 when she called for a general strike to end the government shutdown, breaking the backs of public employees and placing the public at risk. In this period of corporate dominance and Republican rule, advocating for such a militant action, a general strike, made her a champion of working women and men. Perhaps when you listen to Sarah Nelson, you'll agree that radical politics start in the workplace and that workers mustn't be afraid to strike back. Sarah Nelson, president of the Association of Flight Attendants. Let's go.
DSA, sisters and brothers, it's an incredible honor to be here. It's an incredible honor that you asked me to join you for this Debs Parson Randolph dinner. We have other AFA members in the house, and we have the local representative for Air Wisconsin flight attendants here, Jaime Martinez. Where's Jaime? There he is back there. Let me tell you something. A lot of people don't know this, but flight attendants working for regional airlines make 45% less, even though passengers are buying their tickets at the same website. They're often flying on the same routes. They think that they're flying on the same airline, but because these flight attendants are defined as regional flight attendants, the airline industry has come up with this enormous scam to have the regionals compete with each other to keep these workers down. And so we are fighting for a fair contract at Air Wisconsin, and I want you to know that they turned out a 99% strike vote. And on Thursday, we asked the National Mediation Board to release us from mediation so that we can go to that strike deadline and get this company to act fairly. Okay. That was a side note. So I'm here because aviation's first responders did me the great honor of electing me to lead our union, and I never forget that your applause tonight is for them, is for their courage and all the care that they give us. Our union, the Association of Flight Attendants, CWA, with 50,000 members at 20 airlines, some of them flying over us right now, raining down solidarity on this dinner tonight, was formed to beat back discrimination that ranged from quitting at age 30 or stepping on a weight scale until 1993. We even fought for men to have the same rights as women on the job. And we were at the forefront of LGBTQ rights, because it doesn't matter who you love, only that you love. And it's with that spirit that led flight attendants to declare we wouldn't work flights that facilitated this administration's evil policy of family separations, and ended that policy within 48 hours. And it's that spirit that allowed us to take a firm stand during the government shutdown when millions of people were out of work, others were forced to come to work without pay, and all of us were increasingly unsafe. And our entire economy was on the line. With access to 360 million voters in our workplace, seatbelts on, we intend to continue to use that spirit of our union for good. And I just want to put this in perspective. When I was a 23-year-old, fresh-faced flight attendant out of company training, one of the first things I saw on one of my very first trips was a skirmish between my lead flight attendant and the supervisor in the office. My lead flight attendant on that trip won that skirmish. And then she pulled me aside, her voice a little raspy from smoking, and she said, "Listen, management, they think of us as their wives or their mistresses, and in either case, they hold us in contempt. Your only place of worth is with your fellow flying partners, and if we stick together, there's nothing we can't accomplish." And so it's with that spirit that the amazing founders of our union built our union, and it's on their shoulders that I stand tonight, too. I am proud to be with all of you, Chicago Democratic Socialists of America. You have won some great victories in the city this year, and you helped elect some incredible leaders. Are any of them with us here tonight? Okay, woohoo! And still, some ignorant politician, political hack, or media purveyor of hate is likely trashing right now Democratic Socialists. We know it. And here's what I have to say. Helen Keller was a Democratic Socialist. And so was Albert Einstein and George Orwell and Bayard Rustin and the Reuther family. And when Nazi troops came to the Warsaw ghettos to kill the last Jews left, The men and women on the rooftops who met them with gasoline bombs were democratic socialists. And democratic socialists stood up against communist dictatorships throughout the 20th century. They filled Stalin's camps and Siberian graves because they stood for something. The minimum wage, national health care, worker safety rules, Social Security before the Great Society and before the New Deal, this was the democratic socialist agenda. And of course, our democratic socialist working heroes, Eugene Victor Debs, A. Philip Randolph, and Lucy Gonzalez Parsons. And let me just give a shout out for the women leaders. The police called Lucy Parsons more dangerous than 1,000 rioters because of her skills as an orator, an organizer, and rabble-rouser, and her cry that only direct action or the threat of it will move the boss is a lesson we will all do well to remember. So especially today, in this moment of crisis, crisis for working people, crisis for our country, crisis for our world. Just 1 in 10 workers in this country is a party to that charter of freedom and badge of dignity called a union contract. Our republic, the laws that make us civilized, that bind us together through space and time as one country, our republic is mocked every day by the president who swore to defend it and by those who made him in the Republican Party. Around the world, the dark forces of hate-driven dictatorship are on the march, much as they were in the 1930s. Those who seek power through hatred feed on and inspire violence and madness and leave behind random victims slaughtered in prayer, Christian, Jewish, Muslim. And in our schools, our children are thinking about how they can be heroes when they are called upon, rather than thinking about what they want to become and contribute to this world. And yet we are gathered here tonight at a time of tremendous hope and possibility. And so I come here not to make you angry or tell you a bunch of terrible things, but to bring you good news from America's working people and to speak to you in the language that Debs, Parson, and Randolph spoke, the language of solidarity, of hope. I want to summon in your mind's eye the faces of all the people who walked a picket line this past year. Think about them. West Virginia's teachers and their mine worker parents and grandparents. Grocery workers in Boston, hotel workers here in Chicago. Google engineers in San Francisco and Uber drivers in LA. More working people in this country went on strike in the past year than have done so ever, as Sheila tells us. These strikes were workers going on the offense. Workers demanding to be heard, workers striking for a better day, and for one job to be enough. Yes. These were the kind of strikes that Debs, Parsons, and Randolph would have understood because they were visionary, because they built power, because they built right there on the picket line the kind of country that we want to be, where we care for each other, where we fight hand in hand for our democracy. Where our manyness, our many nationalities and race and religions and our diversity of gender and gender identity is a source of pride and strength and love. And because we won. Every one of them. We beat the Wall Street greed heads and their political pawns who want to destroy Los Angeles schools in the service of their profits. We beat the techno barons of Google who thought they could reward sexual harassers with giant pay packages. And as we say here in Chicago, hands off, pants on. We beat the giant multinational corporations who own our nation's hotels and grocery stores and make billions in profits but would have kids go hungry. And we beat the White House. Donald Trump thought he could close our government, stop paying our nation's public servants, hold our well-being as a nation hostage to his racist hatreds. And he thought he could bully everyone. But that's not how it went down. Because the people who run America's aviation system take our responsibility to the public seriously. So we started talking about a general strike because it seemed to be the only way to stop Trump's henchmen from, in the end, getting people killed in American skies. Killed because once the federal government started treating air traffic controllers and transportation security officers like slaves, making them work without pay and under the threat of indictment if they took action against it, more and more people simply couldn't afford to even come to work. It was literally a race against time. But in the end, we won that race when the Federal Aviation Administration closed LaGuardia Airport to air traffic because there weren't enough air traffic controllers. And the punchline here is that this year, America's workers have learned, we have taught ourselves, that we are as brave, strong, creative as our forebears, that we can hold our heads high with the Memphis sanitation strikers, Flint sit-down strikers, the martyred dead of Pullman and Haymarket and Cripple Creek, Colorado, with the mill girls of Lowell and the rebel slaves of Charleston, that if Eugene Debs came back today and went to an LA classroom or a Chicago hotel or a flight attendant union meeting, he would know where he was. And it was the Chicago Teachers Union. Do we have Chicago teachers in the house? Okay. Under the dynamic leadership of Karen Lewis and the teachers who organized at the grassroots part of its core, the caucus of rank and file educators, who showed many of us how it's done. With their incredible strike in 2012, they not only won a great contract, they rekindled the militant, rank-and-file organizing approach that built the early labor movement over a century earlier. And they inspired the strikes of this year, too. Woo! But one strike does not a labor movement make, nor does 5 or 10 strikes. Our great task today, and your task, and my task, is to build a labor movement for this new century, a labor movement for all America's workers, a labor movement as big and bold as America itself, a labor movement that is, as the poet once said in this city, singing so proud to be alive, bragging and laughing that under our wrists are the pulse and under our ribs the heart of the people. During our contract campaign at United, we ran picket lines for 24 hours at airports around the world. Thousands of flight attendants showed up on only a few days' notice, and one flight attendant reported that she heard a woman stop to watch the picketing with her 2 teenage sons. She told them, "See, this is what people are willing to do when they believe in something. They fight for it." And this room knows people are ready to fight. People are waiting for answers, and we have it for them. We need to open our arms wide to all working people and help them join us in building power for all of us. And so I want to talk to you about what you must do, particularly the many young people who are here tonight. Because the labor movement we must build, we will be built by young people, or it won't be built at all. The truth is, the organizers of the great moments of growth in American labor have always been young. The Reuther brothers were in their late 20s when they began to organize, the United Auto Workers. The founders of other unions of the CIO were often even younger than that. And there is a reason why young people lead when the labor movement grows. To grow, we have to build unions that reflect the experience and the needs of the new workforce, and to challenge the entrenched power of the employers. And that was true in the 1890s when Debs founded the American Railway Union, and it was true in the 1930s and the 1970s when teachers and sanitation workers went on strike for the right to organize and bargain, and it is true today. The labor movement needs you to help build it. Part of the task is to build a labor movement that speaks for and to today's workforce, working in jobs that are integrated with miraculous and intrusive and sometimes overpowering technology. And just remember that technology will never replace a beating heart. The Uber drivers proved that with their strike. And the fear of robots is how the rich intend to keep us down. So we have to reject that. We have to embrace it. We have to be a part of it. We have to own it. Part of our task is to build a labor movement that sees itself truly as a labor movement, not just a collection of separate unions, but a movement that is big enough, broad enough to lift up everyone who works in America. Because just as no individual worker can stand alone, no individual union, no matter how big, can stand alone either, or can survive long on its own. We cannot be a movement of a handful of workers here and there, or a movement that lives off our political skills. We also cannot succumb to the temptation of company unionism, of turning into the employer's outsourced HR solution. We must build a powerful democratic labor movement built on solidarity and power in the workplace. A labor movement that is ready to work together with business to build our country, but whose core purpose is to make sure that, whether business chooses to work with us or not, working people will get our fair share of the wealth we help create. And part of that task is to build a labor movement that truly stands for something, a movement with a mission, a movement that embodies the best our country can and has been, a movement that challenges all of us who are part of it to be our better selves. And we can be that movement when we choose to be. In 2017, when the White House abandoned Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria, we, the labor movement, did much more than send money. We filled ships with supplies. We filled a giant plane with skilled union workers, over 300, who spent 2 weeks saving lives and rebuilding communities in Puerto Rico. And Jaime Martinez is one of them here in this room tonight. We turned the power back on in senior centers. We opened schools. Our union nurses and doctors went to remote villages where the wounded and sick remained untreated and were seen for the very first time, places where other people were afraid to go and wouldn't go. The flight attendants were so proud to be a part of the AFL-CIO's Puerto Rico relief mission and to have helped recruit United Airlines to provide us with the plane that we got to take the relief workers to San Juan. And as I've said before, the CEO didn't pick up my call that day because I'm a flight attendant with a big heart. He picked up my call because I beat his ass at the bargaining table. We need as a movement to act in that spirit every day and to bring working people together, all working people, to demand that all who work in America have their efforts recognized, that their dignity is honored, their rights protected, their future fought for as our future. The good news is that every time we fight, we get stronger, and there's no shortage of fights for labor. But it has to start in the workplace. It has to start in real people's everyday lives. If we want to build power for our movement and for working people, start in the workplace and the politics will follow. When we start with what people feel and see in their lives, we can build solidarity. It's amazing what solidarity in a worksite can do. People who may be on opposite ends of a political debate can find common ground when you ground that fight in their workplace. Just a few months ago, my union went to bat for one of our members. Celine was a DACA recipient, a graduate of Texas A&M, and she had been here since she was 3 years old. She had just begun her dream job as a flight attendant. She was assigned a trip to Monterrey, Mexico. When she told her supervisor that she couldn't fly internationally because of her DACA status, only after Trump's executive order, she was told it was okay to take the trip. On probation and afraid to lose her job, she went. But when she came back, CBP stopped her and turned her over to ICE. She was put in a private detention facility in prison-like conditions for 6 weeks, only allowed to go outside a couple times a week. When we learned about her case, our union mobilized and we got her released within 18 hours. The comment that I saw that sticks with me the most during that time was from a conservative member, a Trump voter, who said that she wanted strong immigration laws, but this was too far. Oh, this was too far. All right, can you hear me? Because the fight started in the workplace and because our members understand that in the union, an injury to one is an injury to all. That flight attendant was able to see past her political beliefs to what was right and what was wrong. And now she's someone we can mobilize to fight for a fix to the DREAM Act too. And from there, who knows? And if you start in the workplace, the candidates will follow too. They answer to us. Our unions have long been at the forefront of fights for social justice because we recognize that the basic premise that if we're not all equally protected, none of us is protected. For years, we outsourced our power while the bosses were outsourcing our jobs. We spent too much time trying to cut deals with the boss or build favor with politicians, and too little time organizing members to fight for what we deserve. People think power is a limited resource, but using power builds power. Our workers get a taste of our power, and we will not settle for a bad deal. We won't stand by while someone else gets screwed either. So, the government shutdown was a humanitarian crisis with 800,000 federal sector sisters and brothers who were either locked out of work or forced to come to work without pay due to the lockout. And another million people doing contract work and locked out with no warning. In the private sector, there would have been 60 days notice of the layoff, and no worker would go to work for even one day without getting paid. Even in bankruptcy, the first day orders in the court is to approve paying the workers, because everyone understands that if you don't pay them, they're not going to come to work. But federal workers were under the threat of indictment, and they were also under the threat of privatization. Because if they had walked off the job, Trump would have said, I'll fix it. We can privatize everything and we'll take care of the American people. And that would have been before we heard their stories and their jobs and what this means to us, and he would have gotten away with it. Only because of our unions, we heard the stories of real people who faced real consequences of being dragged into the longest shutdown in history. No money to pay for rent, for childcare, or a tank of gas to get to work. The federal worker stretching insulin through the night and wondering if she will wake up in the morning. The transportation security officer in her third trimester with no certainty for her unborn child. The corrections officer who tried to take his own life because he saw no other way out. The air traffic controller who whispered to his union officer, I just don't see how much longer I can hang on. The TSA officer in Orlando who did take his life by jumping 8 floors to his death in the middle of the security checkpoint. When 2 million workers were locked out or being forced to come to work without pay during the government shutdown, and the rest of us were going to work when our workspace was becoming increasingly less safe, I did ask the labor movement, what are we waiting for? It was time to act with urgency and end the shutdown with a general strike. And the GOP had no idea what that meant. Neither did a lot of Democrats. But they knew it didn't sound good. They knew it sounded like workers might get a taste of our power, and they could not have that. We ended that shutdown because we nearly toppled their entire stranglehold on our country. Many people wanted federal workers with no right to strike to fix this situation for us. And we said, don't put it on the backs of the people who are already locked out. What are you willing to do? Flight attendants made clear our rights allowed us to refuse work in unsafe conditions. And we made clear we were going to exercise those rights. We had to define what was at stake and what leverage we had to fix it. And here we are with this White House, recognizing that the last thing that we can do is take our rights for granted. Mother Jones told us, we will fight and win, fight and lose, but above all, we must fight. Our rights are never absolute. They exist because generations of workers died to give us these rights. They were shot down at Homestead, Pennsylvania, and in the hills of West Virginia. They were hanged for the Haymarket Affair in Chicago and beaten on the overpass in Detroit, all for taking a stand for the rights of working people. There were beatings at Stonewall and murders in San Francisco City Hall. These activists thought it was important enough to take a stand against all odds and put everything on the line to make it better for their families and for our families. And today it's our turn. Sisters and brothers, it's our turn to shape our labor movement. Unions in this country have led mobs against immigrants, and we have lifted up immigrants. We have written union constitutions that excluded African Americans, and yet Dr. King gave his life on a union picket line. We as a movement are not automatically on the right side, but we have to choose to be. We have to live that choice. And today, the choices haven't gotten easier, they have gotten harder. Our lives and our well-being are completely tied together with workers in Mexico, Canada, China, and Germany. Yet politicians in every country seek to divide us, pit us against each other. The energy sector employs millions of workers. Our communities depend on coal, oil, natural gas. Yet carbon emissions threaten our very civilization. We can fight climate change and create the good jobs with rights and benefits, and that's why I support the Green New Deal. But we can only fight climate change if we stand together, if we listen and respect our brothers and sisters in the energy sector, and we demand the rich and the powerful pay their fair share in the fight against climate change. And that we begin by honoring the promise that we made to the people who have kept our cities lit and our homes warmed. Promises that they would have a pension and health care that they could count on when they retired. We are going to make sure that that happens. And finally, unless you have forgotten, we live in a country where Donald Trump is president. Where we take refugees from persecution and violence and put them in cages. Where we separate mothers from children, where our president makes excuses for Nazis and attacks local union leaders, gives trillions to corporations, and threatens to take health care away from the poor. And let me tell you, people like Donald Trump have always tried to woo working people, here in America and around the world. And after a generation of failing wages, of lost pensions, bad trade deals, a lot of people are open to anything, at least at first. But now, we can call him and his buddies for what they are. Frauds, con men, people who with one hand shake their fists at imagined enemies and with the other hand pick your pocket. Sisters and brothers, I learned the hard way at the bargaining table with some of the world's most powerful corporations stacked even with the power of the bankruptcy court that the solidarity and courage of working people is the greatest force for good in human history. As someone said in this city long ago, in our hands is placed a power greater than their hoarded gold, greater than the might of armies magnified 1,000-fold. Solidarity is a force stronger than gravity, and with our collective power comes respect. This is true today, in this city, in this country, in this world, but only if we make it so. So, look to your left, look to your right, tell everyone around you, I've got your back! Thank you, DSA!
And that was the great Sarah Nelson, president of the Association of Flight Attendants, speaking at a DSA convention in Chicago. And get ready now for Vajra Kilgour on Housing Notebook. And be sure to tune in to Mimi Rosenberg on Equal Rights and Justice on Thursday at 9 a.m. It's Ken Nash for Building Bridges. Good night.
And we are WBAI interns.
On a mission to recruit more BAI buddies to support our station.
A BAI buddy is someone who signs up to make a reoccurring monthly donation to WBAI. It's safe, secure, simple, automatic, and means a great deal to keeping our unique essential programming on the air.
To become a BAI buddy, just go to WBAI.org to sign up. Or, if you prefer to sign up through the phone, you may call our call center at 516-620-3602.
Once you join, you will receive a BAI buddy card that allows you to take advantages of member benefits and special opportunities both on and off air, plus a tote bag.
Questions? Just email buddy at WBAI.org. And remember, your support helps keep us on the air.